welcome to Bare Naked Politics, the best podcast in the world, in my humble view, for keeping up with the news. And the reason it's the best podcast for that is because you don't have to be some sort of current affairs expert in order to keep up. No jargon, no weird in-jokes, there's just no expectation on you to have watched the news in the last year. So instead, I just strip it all back, everything that's happening in the headlines, strip it back, explain the politics that literally nobody ever taught you, and you'll always come away from each episode feeling fully informed. Isn't that a lovely thing? It is, it's lovely. I'm Julia Bell, and today, before I get into the bulk of the episode, I actually have a very, very exciting announcement. So to celebrate the 20th episode of Bare Naked Politics, which has been a labour of love and stress for me over the last few months, because I've taken you through Brexit, the American election, the pandemic, crisis, scandal, everything in between. I wanted to do something special just to thank you guys for loyally joining me through the chaos and to sort of for keeping on coming back. So I've teamed up with my friends at Gearbox Records, an independent record label based here in the heart of London, and we've put together the most epic giveaway imaginable, which is completely free for you to enter. It will take about 2 seconds of your time, and the winner will get a bunch of stuff, including a Gearbox automatic turntable record player. So it's worth £550, just that is worth 550 quid. It's completely see-through, this record player that Gearbox have dreamed up and created. It is the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. So lovers of music, this is for you. Also in the giveaway, you're going to get a brand new set of Apple AirPods, so the wireless headphones. You're going to get a Polaroid camera, a year's subscription to Private Eye, which is my favourite political magazine. You're going to get a pile of cash and more. Altogether, it's worth over a grand, and it's going to be sent all to one lucky person, absolutely for free, postage and everything. So in order to be in with the chance of being the proud new owner of all of that stuff, you literally just need to follow me on Instagram, at juliabell_x. You need to follow Gearbox Records as well, at Gearbox Records. And finally, you just need to comment tagging two friends on that giveaway post, which I posted on Thursday the 25th of March. Tag two mates who would also want to get involved. Tag two mates who love music or who love politics or who just need a bit of extra cash, because all of it's included. You can't miss it. The giveaway post is just a picture of all the prizes laid out on a table in all their glory. And the way it works is all the commenters on that post will be added to a pot, and the winner will be randomly selected. We'll do it on camera and we'll show you that to make sure you know it's all fair. And I'll announce the winner on the next episode of the podcast, so on episode 21. Listen, I'll leave a link to the Instagram post so that you can go there directly if you just want to head straight there and get that entry done. I'll leave details about Gearbox Records for those of you who, like me, just love music, especially vinyl, since that's what those guys really focus on. And I do just want to say, before I get going, I just want to say a really quick thank you to Gearbox's founder, Daryl, and the team. Daryl is so supportive of this podcast and what it aims to do, and it was so sweet that he wanted to club together to kind of thank you guys for listening. And we were just talking about, you know, wouldn't it be a world where we can all just sit around and talk about politics in the same way that we talk about music? So with like that excitement and that enthusiasm and that open-mindedness and willingness to learn, you know, I could disagree with you, but then you would be willing to let me talk you through my thought process, and it would be like a fun exchange for both of us. I know that it wouldn't apply to everything, but God, isn't that something to strive for? And that being said, on with the episode. And today is a really nice, juicy topic. What the hell is the House of Lords? What does it do? How did the people within it get their jobs? And isn't it all just horrendously and insultingly out of date? These are the questions. I was actually quite surprised by how many questions I got from you lot. I thought that the House of Lords, you'd kind of view it as this dusty old thing that no one cares about, but you all wanted to know, what is this thing and how much power do they have, and should we be looking to overhaul it altogether? So I'll run through loads of those, and later on in the episode I'll also play you a section where I caught up with my best mate Tash, who just so happens to work for a baroness, aka a member of the House of Lords. So she has great insight into what a day in the life actually is. So I'll play you a lovely big chunk of that conversation later on. But first, just because so few of us actually know what the hell the House of Lords is, I had to do an immense amount of research to put this podcast together because I didn't know a lot of it. So first of all, I'm just going to talk you through the basics of this upper chamber of our very own parliament that all of us are clueless about. All right, so what does the House of Lords do and why is it a thing? On the most basic level, the House of Lords is there to check the House of Commons. It's there as a check, and MPs in the Commons can't really put forward and pass a bill into a law without the House of Lords first reading through it with a fine-tooth comb, adding to it, amending it, debating it, and then ultimately giving it the green light to actually pass back to the Commons for that final vote. And it's all very ceremonial still to this day. So when MPs in the Commons put forward a bill that they want to turn into a law, they then wrap up a hard copy of it, like a printed booklet, and they tie this pretty green ribbon around it to match. The reason it's green is because it matches the seats in the House of Commons, those green seats. And then this man in a cloak and a wig takes it from the Commons physically, crosses the hall into the House of Lords, and then gives it to them so they can do their thing with it. And then they wrap it in a red ribbon to match the seats in the Lords. You know how if you look at videos of the Lords, it's all kind of that burgundy red colour. And at that point, they'd say, right, we've got these things that we want to add or change, pass it back to the Commons and they can see what they think. So that's it on a rudimentary level. Now, I had a question that made me laugh. Billy on Instagram, just by the tone of it, she said, I'd love to see some actual stats on what the House of Lords have achieved. Actual tangible stuff. I've just got a tone there from you that kind of implied you don't think they do anything, which I hear you. So I'll throw a famous example at you, Billy. The Children and Families Act 2014, that was a bill that covered loads of stuff all about children and families. So stuff like children's adoption law, foster care law. There was a bit in it about making sure year one and year two kids at school got free lunches. But the Labour Party looked through that and said, really, we ought to have a section in this bill that stops people from smoking in the car if there are passengers that are children. We should add that into the bill. And certain members of the House of Lords went, yeah, we back that. That's a really good idea. Even though the government at the time, who were Conservatives, did not like that idea. They thought, this is an infringement on people's rights. You probably know that the Tories, they don't love telling people what to do in their private spheres. They're a very kind of laissez-faire party. Do what you do in your private space. But these really vocal members of the House of Lords, who loved that idea of banning adults from smoking in the car with children, they pushed for that to be added into the bill, and they were successful. So that became a law. And yeah, now to this day, it is illegal for parents to smoke in the car with their kids. And that is widely attributed to those members in the House of Lords for taking that bill from the Commons and going, hang on, we need to just force this extra bit in. So there you go, Billy, just one like tangible example of the House of Lords changing something or having like a physical tangible effect on something that we have to live by every day. A couple more basics, because I feel like I've only scratched the surface. To be honest, this is the most I've ever learnt about anything when I was putting an episode together, because when I set out to do this, slowly realised how little I knew about this body of people who are affecting my life every day. It's kind of ridiculous. But yeah, let's cover a few more basics. So the House of Lords, it's the upper chamber in Parliament. Meaning the lower chamber is the House of Commons, and there's about 800 members, which, by the way, makes it the second biggest legislative chamber in the world, the first being the Chinese National People's Congress. And if you think about that, it's absolutely ridiculous. China's population is around 1.4 billion. Our population is 66.5 million. So us having this many people in the House of Lords when we're not that big a country, we're not even top 20. That's question mark number one. Anyway, you might be thinking it's weird that we have an upper chamber and a lower chamber in Parliament, but actually that's pretty commonplace. So in America, for example, The House of Representatives is their lower chamber, and the Senate is their upper chamber. But of course, their Senate is elected, whilst our House of Lords, as you well know, is very much not. Isabel on Instagram asked a really good question. She said, are these people in the House of Lords actually lords? And the answer is yes, Isabel. You can refer to them collectively as lords, but you'll hear more people calling them peers. And so if you're talking about someone in the House of Lords, your best bet is to call them a peer. And in terms of what you call them individually, lots of them do actually go by the title Lord. So that'll be on their bank statements and on their credit cards, which is really, really fun for them. But there's loads of kind of ridiculous, in my opinion, ridiculous sounding titles going on in the House of Lords, which I will talk about in a second. Now, there's two main categories of peers in the House of Lords. And there's one of those which really inspired this episode of the podcast, and that is hereditary peers. So these are exclusively men, because we live in a berserk country that makes no sense. And they, of course, have taken their title after their fathers passed away. So hereditary peers. So, for example, Lord Denham, I believe, is the oldest peer. I believe he's 93 years old. He's been in the House of Lords under 5 prime ministers, and he inherited his title and his position in the House of Lords when his father, also Lord Denham, passed away. So that's hereditary peers, and that's kind of something that I'm going to focus on in this episode, because that group of people are what inspired me to talk about them today. And then there's life peers. This is the other category of peers in there. Life peers who did not inherit their positions. They were granted their positions by nomination. And that nomination is done by the Prime Minister, and then it's confirmed by the Queen. So as time has gone on, as you can imagine, life peers have gotten more diverse. And you've got a few women, not enough in my view, because it's not representative of what the reality of Britain is. And then that stat gets even worse if you look at ethnic minorities, LGBTQ communities, disabled communities. The representation in the House of Lords, even amongst life peers, isn't great, to be honest with you. But something fun that they get is they can choose their own title. So once it's been nominated by the Prime Minister and approved by the Queen, it's up to them, whatever they want to call themselves. So I could be, you know, like Lady Bell of Notting Hill, which, oh my God, that sounds so nice. Or like Baroness Julia of Leeds, whatever you want. And if you're a guy, you could be Lord, Earl, Baron. Excellent perk to being a life peer, as you can choose your own title. Now, the big question that you've all been asking me, including M on Instagram, is how do these peers get their positions if we're not electing them? How does it get to the point where the Prime Minister says, yeah, you can have this role? I mean, it's already clear how hereditary peers do it, because they are just born. they are the firstborn son of their fancy family, and there you go, you can have a position in the House of Lords. Literally blows my mind that that's still a thing. I'll talk about it more in depth later. But when it comes to life peers, and they make up a much bigger majority of the House, like the 700 or so life peers compared to sort of 80-odd hereditary ones, these people are nominated either by their political party. So it might be, for example, somebody who's been an MP for the Labour Party for a long time, and they've held various roles within the cabinet or the shadow cabinet, and they've just generally shown a massive commitment to that party and to the greater good. So the Labour Party, for example, might say, do you know what, we should nominate this person for a peerage. So that's one way. Or you could get nominated by the House of Lords Appointments Commission. And they vet everybody. They're kind of the main body of people who look into who deserves to get a peerage. Or the Prime Minister personally might bung you in. So, for example, Boris Johnson's brother is a peer, which is fun for him. Nepotism.com. But yeah, these are people who perceivably have contributed to society in some major way. So titans of industry that the House of Lords Commission and the Prime Minister ultimately feel would offer really valuable insight in Parliament. Because remember, the House of Lords is there to check the House of Commons and to debate and amend the bills that they put forward. So ideally, you would have people in the House of Lords with a hugely diverse and rich kind of wealth of experience to hold the government accountable in every area. And that's what they do. They represent areas of interest rather than regions of the country, like what MPs do. I went on the UK Parliament website about this because I wanted to see how they worded it. Because obviously they're going to be like, yeah, the House of Lords is a great thing. And this is what it said. It said, members of the House of Lords bring experience and knowledge from a wide range of occupations. Many members continue to be active in their fields and have successful careers in business, culture, science, sports, academia, law, education, health, and public service. They bring this knowledge to their role of examining matters of public interest that affect all UK citizens. So yeah, as I predicted, it was a lot like a sales pitch on the UK Parliament website. Hopefully that gives you a kind of picture of what the House of Lords is and what it does. And by the way, you can put yourself forward for a peerage if you want. As long as, I think the only criteria is you're a UK taxpayer and you're over 21. So if you tick those, then you can apply for a vetting by the House of Lords Appointments Commission. I hear that the interview process is incredibly intrusive and kind of horrific, but if you ask me, it's worth it because the job security and the cloaks and the titles and the fancy dinners, you get that for the rest of your life. It's a life peerage, so it is a cushy gig if you ask me. You're probably listening to this thinking, Jules has lost it. Why is she doing a podcast about the House of Lords? This is so weird. But there's a reason, because they've been a bit of a hot topic in the headlines. And if things build up, I think we might have a little bit of a revolution on our hands, you know, if this snowballs. So this week, the Sunday Times published an article. It was like the big splash on the front page. And it was called Revealed, the Truth About the Peers Who Are Born to Rule. And it's basically a thorough ass, juicy ass investigation into why do we still have these hereditary peers? What do they actually contribute? And how much are they costing us? Us being the taxpayer. And my God, is it a damning article. So the argument came about because the role of Speaker in the House of Lords is currently up for grabs. So it's currently vacant and you've got candidates who are running for it. And two of those candidates are both saying we should abolish this hereditary peer thing once and for all. So obviously they're life peers. They wouldn't be shooting themselves in the foot like that. But they're saying this hereditary thing undermines democracy. It's outdated. It's this kind of archaic insult to modern society. It's kind of a bold thing to do because these two people within the House of Lords are essentially declaring war on a faction of their own house in Parliament. You know, there's at least 85 hereditary peers in their house that they are saying, you don't deserve to be here. But the writers of this Sunday Times article are clearly in agreement with that sentiment because the article starts off by saying, this is a quote, our investigation has found that the hereditaries cost the taxpayer more and contribute less than the life peers do. And it doesn't just say it, it backs it up with absolutely eye-watering numbers. So here it says, hereditary peers, oh, this is going to hurt you. Just to warn you, this is going to hurt your soul. Hereditary peers have cost the taxpayer almost £50 million in expenses claims since 2001. The average hereditary has spoken in the chamber just 50 times in the past 5 years, compared with 82 times among life peers. And when they do speak, they are 60% more likely to mention their own business or personal interests. Oh my God. And this is our parliament of our democratic country that we live in. Regardless as to whether you value tradition and you like to kind of pay your respect to the history of this country, on paper, that sounds about as democratic as a mafia-operated pyramid scheme. If you think about it, because our elected MPs are often, you know, if you watch Parliament TV, they're chomping at the bit to speak in the Commons. You watch them all, you know, when there's a time to ask a question, they're all on their feet hoping that the Speaker will call on them to ask their question and to give a shout out to their voters. You know, they all want to have their voices heard. But for the average hereditary peer, they're speaking 50 times in 5 years. 5 years. That's 10 times a year. Oh, 10 times per year. I mean, these people who, as the Sunday Times pointed out, are costing us, the taxpayer, £50 million every couple of decades. I have questions. I would like to know where my money's going. That's the main question is, where's my money going? Where's my bang for my buck? This article, I'm obsessed with it because it's really kind of, like I say, it's inspired me to talk about this and to delve into it in more depth. But I'll just read out one more section. It says, the 85 remaining hereditary peers are among the least representative of modern Britain. Nearly half, and in brackets it says 39, so 39 of these hereditary peers, went to Eton. The average age is 71. They own at least 170,000 acres between them, which is equivalent to nearly half of Greater London. This is not an accurate depiction of the fabric of the country. Nearly half of these hereditary peers went to Eton. I'm just not sure I'm that comfortable knowing that they have as many rights as the life peers, and so they can vote, should they wish to, on every bill that will directly affect our lives. It's just a really, it's an expose, isn't it, this article? It was written by Gabriel Pogrund and Tom Calver. Got to give them big props for this. But my favourite thing actually about it, and I talked about it briefly on my Instagram stories the other day, is where there's this kind of interactive chart. And it shows all the faces. It's like this big sea of old white men. It shows all the faces of these hereditary peers, right, that still sit in the House of Lords. And there's 85 of them. And if you hover over whoever's face, you can pick a face, hover over it, then a box pops up which tells you a bit about them, including how much that person costs us, the UK taxpayer. And it's terrifying. In fact, why don't I just do it while we're on the podcast? Because I've not looked at all of them. Here's the article. See, this is why I don't read the papers. People have a go at me for not reading the papers physically. But most of these articles end up in digital versions on the websites, and they can't, you know, the papers can't have a lovely interactive graph. It's just so sexy. Who would have said that word would be used in the same context as the House of Lords? Okay, so I'm going to hover over somebody and let's have a chat about them. Lord Mancroft, aged 63, expenses claimed since 2001, £721,865. Oh, £750,000. And he joined the Lords in 1988. So he'll have claimed expenses before 2001 as well, but this just shows the sort of £750,000 that he's claimed since then. And then it's got a bit about him. He was educated at Eton and has been a lifelong defender of fox hunting. He has suggested that fox hunters care more about foxes' welfare than animal rights activists. What? What the fuck? You'll love to see it. Let's hover over somebody else. Oh, I found one who's barely spent anything. Earl Home. Family peerage started in 1473. Wow, that is a long lineage of powerful men. Expenses claimed since 2001. Get this for Earl Home, £14. £14. That's not bad. That is interesting. And then on his information, it says, Earl Home raised eyebrows last year when he urged ministers to make it a criminal offence to feed grey squirrels. And this is, he hates grey squirrels. Listen to this quote. It may also be helpful if people knew that grey squirrels are extremely good to eat. I have eaten them. My God. But he's only spent £14 in expenses since 2001. So we've got our bang for our buck in some senses there. And here we go. This is the big daddy. Earl of Shrewsbury. This is the last one, I promise. But it's a bloody good thing, isn't it? Earl of Shrewsbury. Family peerage started in 1442. And his expenses claimed since 2001, are you ready for this? £915,581. Earl of Shrewsbury. Just £85,000 short of £1 million in expenses since 2001. Where are you eating? What restaurants are you going to that we're paying for? What hotels are you staying at? I want to know what these expenses are, because £1 million in 20 years, just on expenses. I have questions for you, Mr. Shrewsbury. Now look, the hereditary peer thing hasn't gone unnoticed and under the radar for all of this time. It's definitely kind of popped up in conversation and then died back down again. But Tony Blair, when he was Prime Minister, he had, in my opinion, the most revolutionary approach to the House of Lords in modern political history.
A bill will be introduced to remove the right of hereditary peers to sit and vote in the House of Lords. It will be the first stage in a process of reform to make the House of Lords more democratic and representative.
So that was the Queen speaking at the opening session of Parliament in 1998. You know, where she reads a short speech summing up what the government intends to do. And also, guess where she sits and reads it? That's right, the House of Lords. So when she does these kind of parliamentary opening ceremonies, she sits on that big throne in the House of Lords. So get your head around this. She's an unelected monarch sitting on a throne in front of a bunch of unelected hereditary peers, saying, you guys don't represent democracy anymore, so you're going to get the sack. Isn't British politics just the best? And the thing is, just as the Queen summarised Tony Blair's plans, he absolutely set to work on getting that done, because he produced the House of Lords Act, which pretty much set out to remove the right for any peers to inherit their spot in the House of Lords. It wanted to just get rid of that idea altogether. And again, I love thinking about that because, as you now know, in order to get any bill passed into law, it has to go back and forth between the House of Commons and the House of Lords to be debated and amended. And, you know, they tie their red ribbon around it and all the rest of it. So these peers in the Lords were having to go through the motions that they do with every bill with this House of Lords bill, which outlined why they don't deserve to exist. They're sitting there reading this bill that says, you guys don't deserve to be there. You love to see it. And as you can imagine, some of these peers, these hereditary peers, absolutely kicked up a stink, you know, even threatening to hold up and mess around with any other unrelated bills that Blair was trying to pass, which again doesn't scream democracy to me, but what do I know? So the famous example of Lords getting pissed off with this bill was the Earl of Onslow, who at the time said, quote, I'm happy to force a division on each and every clause of the Scotland bill. Each division takes 20 minutes and there are more than 270 clauses. I'm sorry, but the ball's on this guy. You know, the Scotland Act had absolutely nothing to do with the House of Lords Act. It's completely unrelated. And the Scotland Act was incredibly important for democracy. It essentially allowed for a devolved Scottish Parliament. And it said, do you know what, Scotland? You guys ought to have more power over how things run up there. So here's your own Parliament. Here's your own margin over deciding taxes and your own laws. Just have some more power. That's what that act was. And it's something that Scots still don't think they have enough of today, is they want more power. You know, that's why we've got this independence debate still happening. And this Earl of Onslow guy was willing to roadblock the shit out of that to save his interests, you know, with this inherited peers thing. Literally blocking a law that would have furthered democracy in Scotland in order to protect his own inherited position, which, let's be honest, is actively undemocratic. It's audacious. It's outrageous. It's contagious. But still, right, so Tony Blair came up with an absolute shitstorm from certain members within the House of Lords, and that meant that he had to bend a bit on this House of Lords Act in order to get it pushed through. So what they had to do was they had to make room for 92 hereditary peers to stay put. And it was actually really as an interim thing. So they said, look, for now we're going to allow it, but eventually we are still going to get rid of those 92 as well. And on that basis, with that compromise, the bill became law. But here we are in 2021, and, you know, more than 20 years later, and there are 85 hereditary peers still in the House of Lords. And that was really not Tony Blair's intent. The intent was to get rid of them all, but just have this interim period. And here we still are. And that's actually something that this Sunday Times article picks up on. I will kind of keep harking back to it because it really is the inspiration for this episode. But it said, this is a quote, "The presence of hereditaries was supposed to be a temporary compromise after most were removed in 1999. However, two decades on, they retain the right to make or amend laws and claim £323 a day, tax-free, plus travel for parliamentary work." £323 a day, not including travel. I thought that's what expenses were. Again, my main question is, what are you eating? Now, you guys still want to kind of understand more about what the House of Lords do. I gave you one or two pretty gammy examples, and I get that that might not be enough. So lucky for us, my best mate of 10 years, Tash, she works for one. She works for a baroness who has a spot in the House of Lords. And you know when I read that thing out from the UK Parliament website about the Lords and it said they often keep up their business outside of their parliamentary work? Well, that's kind of where Tash comes in. So her boss, this baroness, she runs an organisation focusing on child protection online. And Tash works within that. So that means she gets immense insight into what a day in the life of a peer actually is and the powers she has and what she kind of does with that power. So I asked her to talk me through it. So you work for a member of the House of Lords. She's a baroness. That's a title that's been given to her, right?
Yeah. So I work for a child's rights organisation and the person who was the founder, who is the founder, and the chair of Five Rights is Baroness, but she was given that title because of her dedication to British film. So she was a film director and producer for 30 years. And because of her skills and talent in that area, she was given that title. So it's not because of hereditary reasons, it was because of her experience and what she gave to Britain.
Yeah, so and that is a title she gets for life, right?
Yeah, for life. So but it stops at her. So she doesn't get done. She doesn't pass it down to her children.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ah, whereas for hereditary peers, it does. And that's the difference.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So they can pass it down.
What do you call her when you address her?
Her first name.
Okay. So you don't have to say Baroness, blah, blah, blah.
No, I did. I was, like, when I first got the job, because I had come from the civil service where she was, like, such a force. Mm-hmm. To be reckoned with, I was like, Baroness. And she was like, can you just not call me that? It's fine.
But if I were to meet her, I would have to refer to her as Baroness. It's like when you meet a royal, is it?
The thing... I wouldn't even say so. It really depends on the person. So if they want you to call them Lord or Baroness, they'll let you know. Okay. Or they'll get their assistant to let you know. But if you know them outside of a context of their parliamentary work, then you can call them by their first name.
Because this is the thing, right? This is the big question that I've had from everybody is, no offence, what do these people do? What do they do? What, in fact, the big question I've had is, what is the point in these people? Mm. If you had to... because you've had so much exposure to what she does, even outside of the company that you work for. If you had to succinctly describe a day in the life of a peer in the House of Lords, what would that look like?
So again, this is all dependent on how active or passive the Lord is, or Lord or Lady. But for example, the Baroness I work for, she's active in a sense that she will comment on amendments, she'll bring them forward in bills. So you know your last podcast, you were talking about a bill.
Oh, love you. Did you listen to it?
Of course.
Oh, I love you.
Obsessed. but like you mentioned, that bill's quite controversial.
Yeah,
but
just for anyone who didn't catch it, it's the Policing, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Bill. And it's that's the one that has this big section in it about how it might strip us of all our protest rights, essentially. And yeah, that's sort of been going back and forth between the House of Commons and the House of Lords.
Yeah, and that's what they call ping pong. So
Okay. Basically,
it can be busy and it might not be very busy, but the person I work for, she actually had an amendment to the Data Protection Act in 2018, and she brought that forward. So she brought that forward in the House of Lords. Then it has its first reading, second reading, third reading. then goes to the House of Commons.
And the House of Lords, particularly with Brexit, for example, they put lots of amendments forward. I got the impression they were all kind of Remain-y anyway. They were sort of a roadblock in a lot of ways for the Tories to get stuff done. And as someone who, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about the House of Lords' existence, the fact that they're not elected. Mm. These people were either given their peerages or they inherited them, and it's within their total capacity to make up laws that we all have to follow.
I think I was totally against the House. So I was teaching students politics, like A-level students politics, and I remember teaching them about how we need constitutional reform with the House of Lords. Mm-hmm. And I was like, great, Tony Blair in the time that we all liked him. and he was like, right, we're going to reform the House of Lords. And I was like, yes. I was seven, but still, you know, I was like, yes, that's what we need to do. But since working for someone who actually sits in the House of Lords, I'm really glad for the extra scrutiny, because hereditary peers have been reduced because of Tony Blair's constitutional reform. So as they slowly fade away, the life peers are the ones who are actually there for a reason, and their reason is their dedication to building up British society or having a specific skill.
Yeah.
So a lot of lords and ladies and baronesses are often advisors and can be advisors to government officials.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember when Lord Sugar, Alan Sugar, got given a peerage?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, you know, somebody like him, who's going to know more about how a business operates in the UK?
Yeah.
He ran multiple very successful businesses and built his brand on that. So if I were a government minister talking about business, I would want his input.
Mm.
And I suppose, are you saying like that's what the House of Lords does? They offer their counsel, but they also hold ministers in the cabinet to account on things that they probably know less about than the members of the House of Lords.
100%.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you know, the person I work for, she has a particular expertise now in children's rights in the digital world. And she will, in her being involved in Parliament, really does help government understand that sector. And she's got specialist expertise. And every time she speaks about a particular topic, it will always come back to, how are we protecting children? How are we supporting children online in the digital world? And I really appreciate that.
But how, political. But your boss's background is in film. That's why she was given her OBE.
Yeah.
That's why she was made a baroness.
Yeah.
So then why is she talking so much about children and data protection?
So she made a documentary about children, and she was spending all their time, like all her time with these children, like watching what they were doing, recording what they were doing, and they spent a lot of time online. And basically the internet was viewed as a democracy where every single person on the internet was equal, but a child should not be equal to an adult on the internet. And she just saw that, and she was like, why are they being treated as adults when they should be given the right to develop as children? And she saw that with her documentary filmmaking.
Okay.
And she said, we need to change this. And wow, I'm up against big tech. How can I use my political power and also create a foundation where we focus on children's rights in the digital world?
But was that known when she was given her peerage? Like, we want to give you this peerage so you can look after children. Or was it like, we kind of got lucky with her because really the intent was for her to talk about film within the capacity?
Yeah.
See, this is what worries me.
I understand.
That went well. Like, she sounds like she's a cool lady. She's doing some cool things. And, like, I'm glad that there's somebody thinking about children within the context of the internet in the House of Lords, because that's something that I imagine a lot of members of the House of Lords don't know much about, is the internet, just based on the average age. But it could also go the other way.
You're absolutely right.
We give somebody a peerage for the stuff they've contributed, and then it turns out that they've not got much interest in talking about that anymore, and they decide their new passion is something else entirely that doesn't really benefit society. That's a worry, that they can basically pick and choose whatever their specialty is and then devote all their time to that.
No, absolutely. And to be honest, like, it is lucky that she's found this niche in the market, but if it wasn't for her position, she wouldn't necessarily might have had that platform to do it.
Yeah.
There must be a lot of other people who also saw that trend and pattern happening, but they didn't have a platform to shout about
it. They didn't happen to have a film background that led to having an OBE that led
to being... And the people who have got these peerages, they already have a platform, because you don't get to a certain place without knowing the right people or doing the right thing or having the experience. So if you've already got the platform, what is the need to sit in Parliament, right?
Yeah. Do you think there's big egos in there?
Oh, yeah. Really? I mean, anyone who is in politics has some sort of ego.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to be, you know, humble McHumbleson, are you?
No. One of the arguments I've heard, and I wonder what you think of it, is because peers are given a life peerage, there's no panic about being re-elected. So they're not wasting time trying to win over voters, and they're able to just focus in on their work. Mm. Do you feel that? Do you feel like there isn't that much fuss about what the public thinks?
Again, so I think it depends on if you're a passive or active member of Parliament. If you really want to get involved and have your say, then there's no worry that you're not going to be re-elected if you're outspoken.
Yeah, but exactly.
But if you're passive, then you're chilled, you're like, I don't really care about the title, but I've got it. You know, you do have those members.
So it depends on your outlook.
It really does. Like, for example, the person I work for, she really cares. And one thing I've actually noticed is that every time she's in the House of Lords, because she's a cross-party, like she's a cross-party peer, which means she doesn't have a particular affiliation, she sits on all.
So she is not a member of any party?
No, she isn't.
Okay, okay.
So she's not affiliated, but she's cross-party, so she can sit. She basically gets consensus from Conservative, Labour, Liberal, so they agree with what she's saying. And in the House of Commons, that's a little more rare, I would say.
Oh my God,
You know, absolutely. So there's less consensus, and I do feel like there's more of a consensus in the House of Lords.
So it's a bit more collaborative.
I would say so.
Okay. Okay.
And it's because they don't have, I don't know, they're not elected, so they don't necessarily have the public power. And it was weird, I was taught that they didn't have any political power, they didn't have legislative power, but actually I think they have both.
Of course they do.
You know?
Of course they do.
No, but you know when you get taught, oh, they're just the House of Lords, we'll get rid of them, etc. It's not a big deal. But they have both. Obviously now we know that they can bring legislation, propose legislation, but they also have political power, because some people really don't want to upset certain lords or certain baronesses, or, you know.
There's a prestige, isn't there? Because you do have quite a few MPs who have been in the same seat for decades upon decades, and their constituents are incredibly loyal to them, and they have this kind of air of authority within the House of Commons. But they're always affiliated to a party. Mm. So there's always going to be an enemy for that person. Whereas perhaps in the House of Lords, there are people who have been there since like the 60s who have been sat in the same seat doing the same thing every day. And I wonder if, because there's less of a contrary party culture, that person is just universally respected and therefore they would have more sway with whatever the topic was.
Yeah, I mean, I still think there's an element of reform that needs to happen.
Because, I was going to ask you, like, ultimately, bottom line, do you agree with the fact that the House of Lords existed? Or if somebody said to you, tomorrow we can overhaul the whole thing, and your boss will still be, like, that role will still exist, but they would need to run to be elected into it.
Yeah.
Would you say yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I really don't understand how we can say we're the beacons of democracy when there are, like, 900 or less, you know, people who are unelected, who scrutinise bills and propose amendments. No matter how kind or good they are for society, there's still someone who has a say in our future that we have not elected to be there.
Yeah.
And I obviously respect my boss so much because she's doing something for societal good.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't get the same sort of character.
Well, thank you, Angel.
Thank you.
I feel like people really get it now.
Well, I hope so. I mean, look, it's very confusing. I'm confused half the time, so so it's nice to have a chat about it, because I think it's great to critically engage with things you haven't really thought about for a while.
It forces you to step back and go, wait, who am I working for? What am I doing? So that's cool.
So, yeah, just see me handing you my notice next time.
All right, love, thank you.
Bye.
So that was Tash, my best pal of 10 years, who works for the office of a baroness. So she's not a hereditary peer, she's a life peer in the House of Lords. Well, of course she's not a hereditary peer because you can't be one if you're a woman, which is just, I can't get over how weird this is. How is this still a thing? But anyway, I found it really cool that Tash was so forthright to say, look, I respect and I love the work that I do, but we probably still should think about changing the House of Lords to some degree to make it more democratic. So I kind of appreciated how candid she was about that. And you can decide how you feel. You know, would you want, how nuanced would you want this to be? Would you want a complete overhaul of the whole thing to replace it with something like the Senate in America, which is, of course, an elected body? But then we have to remember that that system, the American system, is not something that we should necessarily be revering. I know that Americans would argue that it's the best thing ever, but they have their own nightmares because their system is often completely held hostage by party politics. And when party politics dominates in both houses, you end up with problems. So, for example, we saw it under Donald Trump. The Republican Party, his party, had control of the Senate, while the Democrat Party, his most hated opposition party, had control of the House of Representatives. And what it meant was the Democrats in the House of Representatives just blocked everything that Donald Trump tried to do. And you ended up with this kind of political stalemate where the two houses just cancelled each other out. And that happens all the time. I think there's a clip of Barack Obama getting genuinely teary when he was in charge, and he had the reverse situation where Congress was kind of at this political stalemate with the Republicans. And he was getting teary because he felt so powerless. He really wanted to change laws about guns in America, and he wanted to kind of clamp down on gun control. But he couldn't because the Republicans just blocked everything he did. So you kind of end up with a stalemate. Or, on the other hand, and as you know, we can use America as a nice template for this, if both houses are dominated by the same party, then it becomes dead easy to pass laws for that party. And anything they want to happen, they can just make it happen. And you've not really got a strong body to continuously hold them to account and to block them if they think they're not doing the right thing. So there's always kind of some, don't just assume that democracy, direct democracy, is always the best answer, because it can end up being a bit of a poison chalice in a lot of ways. And I think we have seen that in America. But still, you might think, doesn't matter, even if it's a shitstorm, democracy is the answer, and we should always strive for that. So that's what we need to do. Or you might say, and to be honest, this is where I'm leaning at the moment, you might say, okay, the House of Lords needs a partial overhaul. We need to get rid of hereditary peers, essentially. We need to finish the job of Tony Blair's 1999 House of Lords Act. But let's keep life peers for now, because that system seems to be doing us okay. It's not that democratic, and it's certainly not representative. We need to strive to represent more accurately the UK public. But let's just keep it as it is for now and keep reviewing it as we go along. I do wonder, though, if my outlook on that is just because I'm so tired. I'm so tired, you know, after Brexit and then this pandemic, and then we've got, you know, a potential independent Scotland happening round the corner. Your honey's tired. I don't know if I can handle a complete parliamentary overhaul where we end up with a similar system to America, which, let's be honest, is a knackering system as well. They have a kind of tribal war happening over there because party politics is so entrenched. So I wonder if I just don't want to do it because I'm knackered. Right, we've got more questions. Let's just get a few of these done before we finish. So Amy on Instagram said, if this is really a job for life, then who holds peers to account to ensure they're doing the right thing? And I guess, Amy, you're asking, can peers get sacked if they don't do the right thing? And it's a fantastic question, because these are parliamentarians. Even if they're not elected, they're at least meant to be, surely, accountable to the public whom they seek, or at least claim, to serve. Well, historically, Amy, the answer is no, they weren't accountable to anything. The House of Lords had absolutely no power to expel any of its members for anything. Even if they committed a criminal offence, they still wouldn't get kicked out of the Lords, and they wouldn't lose their title. Love it. Classic double standards of the aristocratic class in this country. But then came along, well, there's been a few measures, but the big one was the House of Lords Expulsion and Suspension Act in 2015. like worryingly recent, but this basically said, hang on, we should definitely be able to sack peers if they breach the House of Lords code of conduct, let alone if they commit an actual crime. So if they commit a crime or if they breach the conduct, they ought to get sacked. And the House of Lords code of conduct, by the way, it's just essentially like a rule book for how you're expected to behave. And, you know, you have to go about your parliamentary work with transparency and integrity, and, you know, you can't exploit your position, basically. Right, I'm digressing, but Amy, essentially you're asking, are they accountable? Historically, no, they weren't. Now, yes, they are to this code, and they are to the laws of the country. So recently there was a case where a member of the House of Lords was caught taking cocaine, and I think people thought, oh, he's going to get the sack. This is going to be the first occasion of this, but he actually stood down before that happened. So they're accountable to that, but that's about it. They're not really accountable to us, the public, because we didn't vote for them. And not being accountable to us means that they do just have way more freedom than MPs do. So like Tash said, they can definitely be more outspoken and they can enjoy that freedom to voice their opinions without fear that their party is going to come down on them like a ton of bricks. And they've also never made promises to constituents about what they're going to do. So they're never going to have entire regions of the public who are pissed off with them for breaking promises, because they've never had to get elected and they've never had to promise us anything. And of course, don't forget, if they opt to be silent on 99% of issues, then that's up to them, since they represent areas of interest more than regions of people. So you get quite a lot of them, quite a lot of these peers that go, do you know what? This isn't my area. I don't know about this. So I'm not going to vote because it's not really my place. So a peer with a background in farming might not necessarily want to vote on and amend bills about international security, because they might be like, this just isn't my area. I don't think it's fair that I talk about this. But an MP couldn't do that. An MP couldn't just sit there for 99% of things and go, do you know what? This isn't really my area. That person's constituents would be like, what the fuck? Please, can you have an opinion about it? Because you're meant to be directly representing us. And of course, it's not just the public that the MPs have to pander to. They've got to pander to their party. So you've got party whips who are going around telling MPs, you're voting for this or you're voting against this because this is what the party believes and you better vote in line with us. So they've got all these different pressures that the peers don't have. I mean, a lot of peers in the House of Lords are affiliated with parties and they sit across from each other in the House of Lords, much like they do in the Commons. But you have these crossbenchers who sit in the middle who don't affiliate with any party. And even the ones who do, they weren't voted in there by the public. So for instance, like if you live in an area and you voted for a Tory MP, then you want that Tory MP to be a Tory. Do you know what I mean? You want them to do Tory things because that's what you voted for them on the basis of. You read the Tory manifesto and you said, you know what, I want to put a Tory MP in there to do Tory stuff. But a Conservative peer in the House of Lords isn't going to get that same pressure to be a classic Conservative. Does that make sense? There's not a region of people demanding that of them, so they can focus on each bill and kind of apply their own nuanced approach to it. Maybe you think it's a good thing. You know, from all of that, maybe you're thinking, actually, having a whole body of people, a massive body of people in the House of Lords who have this freedom to focus on stuff and to not worry about being re-elected and to not be making promises to us that they can't necessarily keep, this is a good thing because it means they can actually get the job done. But then maybe you're looking at it thinking, this just doesn't seem right that we've got these people in there that have their interests, but they're potentially squandering loads of opportunities to scrutinise the government on other stuff. So for example, Tash's boss, this baroness that comes from a film background and she has this passion for protecting children online, she might not necessarily feel that she has jurisdiction to talk about, I don't know, roadworks. Like, if there's a bill that's going through about, you know, should we have this new traffic light system, would she necessarily feel empowered or obliged to talk about it? Maybe that's a squandering an opportunity that an elected person would take up. It's up to you. I would love to know what your point of view on this is. I had one more question that I'll finish off with from Lily on Instagram. And she said, what would it take for the House of Lords system to change or to be overhauled altogether? I suppose, Lily, the most straightforward way would be constitutional reform. So basically passing a bill into a law that changes the system in the same way that the House of Lords Act was done by Tony Blair in 1999, which removed most hereditary peers, or this Expulsions and Suspensions Act in 2015, which said actually we should be able to sack peers. That kind of thing is probably the most straightforward way that we would do it. So say something like that happened and you got like a group of MPs who were particularly anti-House of Lords, and they clubbed together and wrote a bill that would abolish the whole thing and that would turn it into something else. You know what happens? They write the bill, they print it out, they wrap it in green ribbon, and it gets taken across to the House of Lords. And so then the House of Lords have to read it and go, well, I mean, imagine what would happen. They would go, we hate this. We don't want this to happen. The answer's no. So I can't imagine you'd get a huge amount of support for a bill that got rid of the whole thing in this sort of traditional sense. Alternatively, though, Lily, just sort of talking about how would we overhaul, I think the big way that it would actually happen is if the public became directly enraged about it. Because then you could end up seeing pressure applied to the government to promise a referendum, which is where the public get a direct say. Because if the public gets riled up about something, that does result in laws being changed and made. Think Marcus Rashford, the footballer who managed to rile up public support to get the government to U-turn and ensure kids could keep a hold of getting free meals during the pandemic. That was a huge thing, and it kind of resulted from pressure from outside of government. I feel like that is the more likely way that something would actually end up getting done about this. And I don't know how likely it would be for the public to get riled up about the House of Lords. It's just not a very sexy topic. But it happened with Brexit. That I think that's how we ended up with a referendum, is this sort of perceived pressure that David Cameron felt, because I think he was panicking that he would lose lots of Conservative voters and that they would start trading in their support for the more right-wing UKIP. So to win them over, to keep a hold of them, he promised them a referendum on Brexit, which is something that, the right-wing faction of the Conservative Party at the time wanted. That's why they were wavering and dripping over to UKIP. So that's why David Cameron said, all right, we'll give you this Brexit vote. And I think at the time he rather naively thought, oh, there's no way the public will actually go for this, but it's a win-win for me. I'll keep my Tory voters and I'll still hang on to our place in the EU. David, hindsight's a bitch, isn't it, my hun? But I guess, if a future government felt immense pressure in the same way, and they thought, oh my God, we're going to lose voters if we don't promise a referendum on reforming the House of Lords, then that probably would result in something. Because, yes, the House of Lords would still need to green light it, but if the mandate for that change comes directly from the public, if the demand is from the public rather than from a random group of MPs, then what leg does the House of Lords have to stand on? This unelected body. If the public are all standing up and saying, we want rid of you, how can an unelected group of not very representative people, some of whom got their spots by privilege of being born, I don't think they could stand much in the way. So I think that's how it would happen. It could happen one day. I just don't know if it'll happen anytime soon because we're all fucking exhausted. Okay, I need to bring this to a close or else it'll end up being an hour-long episode about the House of Lords. I think it is literally going to be an hour long, which is absolutely absurd. Surely I've surpassed some sort of record with that. Look, before I let you go, I want to leave you with just a short section of, the Sunday Times writers I referenced earlier, Pogrund and Calver. Well, they wrote this kind of sister article called Is It Time to End the Farce of Hereditary Peers in the House of Lords? I'll link both of the articles I've talked about because they were essentially the inspiration behind this episode. But this kind of sister article opens with something that sounds like a chapter from a book, like Game of Thrones. It doesn't feel like it could truly be the political reality of modern day Britain, but it is. And I thought I'd leave you with it so you get a real insight into what our country, into how it operates. So this is what it says. Lord Selsdon, a hereditary peer in the House of Lords, made a frank admission to colleagues not so long ago. I'm not quite sure why I'm here, he said. The retired banker and wine producer, aged 83, described the circumstances in which, aged 26, he'd inherited his title and a lifelong seat in Parliament. It all happened one day when I was working in Brussels, and someone came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "My lord, could I have a word?" I said, "I'm not my lord, I'm just me." He said, "I'm afraid I've got some news for you. Your father died this morning at sea and he's been buried. You are now Lord Selsdon." Isn't that something? And that's how this gentleman, Lord Selsdon, got his place in Parliament. And he's got as many voting and amendment rights as any life peer in the House of Lords. And these things that they're voting on and amending directly affect your life. If you're listening from the UK, that is. It's just kind of astounding, isn't it? That seems like the opening chapter of a very old-fashioned story, but it's modern-day British politics. But tell me what you think. I love to hear from you, as long as it's not nasty. And do you know what? Give me delicious, nuanced arguments. I don't want to hear just like a blanket, aggressive statement about how much you hate the world. Tell me like what the current parliamentary system should be and why. Cherry pick aspects that you like and don't like. I love that shit. So follow me on Instagram to get in touch at juliabell_x. And of course, you've got to follow me this week because I've got this ridiculous giveaway happening in collaboration with the fabulous Gearbox Records. If you found this episode helpful, I say it every week, but you know, if it is interesting or informative, you came away from this episode thinking about loads of stuff, then I've done my job. And to be honest, the only way to keep it going is if you become a patron. So the link for my Patreon page is in the episode description. If you click on there and if you become a member, then you get loads of exclusive content and you've got that nice knowledge that you're keeping this going. So get involved with that. And that's it for me this week. Just thank you. Thank you so much, especially those of you who have been kind of along for the ride for a lot of these episodes now. You've been so kind and you've been really eager to learn and you've been sending in your questions. And I can't really do these episodes without you sending those in because it gives me an idea of what you want to know. So to those of you who have done that, thank you so much. I just want to make this bigger and better as I go along. I'm trying to keep on improving on it and make it exactly what it is that you want and the most useful kind of resource for you. And hopefully when you listen to them, it's not dreary. It's just that you come away feeling okay. That's the aim for sure. So I hope I can keep providing that for you. Thank you so much for all of your kindness. And I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.